ready to start a new group of papers. The block on the rest of existential deity. You know, right at the beginning of paper 6, the rest of existential deity, you've got the Son and the Spirit and the Paradise Trinity. So we had the first set of 5 papers, now we're going to do the second set of 5. And there's sort of a triune Pentateuch that the book starts out with. And so paper 6 starts on page 73. So, yeah, there's no preface here. Let's just jump in. Who wants to start reading here? Okay.
Paper 6, The Eternal Son. The Eternal Son is the perfect and final expression of the first personal and absolute concept of the Universal Father. Accordingly, whenever and however the Father personally and absolutely expresses himself, he does so through his eternal Son, whoever has been, now is, and ever will be, the living and divine Word. And this eternal Son is residential at the center of all things, in association with and immediately enshrouding the personal presence of the eternal and universal Father.
Okay, so first of all, let's just note one little thing, because you'll see it's a theme all the way through the preface here of this paper. And we're all pretty familiar with this, but let's just remind ourselves of this basic issue. Why did he put, quotes around the word first? As we all know, he's about to explain, he's going to present things as if they occurred in a time sequence. But of course, when you're talking about existential deity, that's all atemporal phenomenon. It not only, it's more than it happening before time, it's fundamentally, absolutely no relationship to time. Just like they're saying, always has been, is now and ever will be. Absolutely atemporal. So on the one hand, you go, okay, but he's going to do this just so that we can kind of get it. But, he could have, not used the word first. There's a reason why he still used the word first. And, and then, of course, put it in quotes so that, no one misunderstands. We've talked about that a number of times. Does anyone... remember, yes, it's not temporally first, but there is another way to understand that. What's the basic, issue in play that they're trying to get us to think in terms of? Not just some sort of a temporal, rational phenomenon, yes, but it's still, there's a causal, a logical construct of reality.
Sequence.
You can still certainly, in order to really express your logical recognition, you'll say sequence, a logical sequence. And it's a matter of recognizing you're not just saying that because of all these caveats we're about to read that, you're time bound and the universe is inherently causal, logical. You have a first source and center and a second source and center, not because, they happened in a time sequence, but you can understand the causal relationship between things by speaking of them in that way. Initially, if you need to, you can think of a time sequence, like he's going to say. To help you kind of get going. Because, obviously the book is constructed in a very evolutional fashion. And everyone is coming from a very time-oriented concept of God and a very individuality-oriented concept of God. And so if you have no notion of the unity that is deity, all you have is some sort of attempt to go beyond an anthropomorphic sort of a notion. I mean, it's going to be a fairly simple time idea that you're going to have in your head if you have any sort of a theology sort of to how it all hangs together. But, more so than making the book an evolutional construct so that it basically meets us where we are. You know, by speaking this way, you know, they're subtly challenging you to cultivate a more causal mode of thought. To not just take everything for granted. It's like, well, okay, I'll just try to memorize that. You know, challenge yourself to have a causal recognition that you can lock on to this stuff with, so that you don't have to memorize anything. It's just apparent, self-evident, how things connect together. It just can't be any other way. And when you can get to the point where you can start to see a number of things just have to be that way, your whole relationship to the revelation will start to shift. You'll start to see things that you didn't see before. And you'll start to go, well, you know, this is not as hard as I thought it was at all. That's certainly their desire. The only reason I spend so much time on that is, you'll notice that it's not just the next paragraph where he kind of explains himself. He seems to go on and on and on with it. It's like, okay. I mean, he's really trying to make this point that there's a transcendent reason for speaking like this. And he's not going to spoon feed that recognition to you, but he's going to just really, like he so often does, suggest, you know, a lot of times just by repetition to the point where you might get frustrated and go, why on earth is he doing this to me? And then you might, ask a better question about, the construct.
Well, it says the Father expresses himself through the Son. Mm-hmm. So does he not express himself in words directly, apparently?
Well, we just read a number of things about how the Father engages the universe directly. I mean, a great example, very literally, of the word of the Father directly, not through the Son, is a personalized adjuster. When a personalized adjuster, engages some point in space and time, that is the Father speaking.
Right.
Just notice that it's just, he starts out very limited. He's not going to invoke a lot of those more evolutional things that he's going to in a little bit here. But just that idea that there's going to be, there's multiple personal concepts. There may be even multiple absolute. We know we've got another absolute being coming up in a little bit, conjoint actor. But in some very transcendent way, you want to recognize this as being primal, quote unquote, first.
What's interesting is when God creates the eternal Son, and He wants, so He's right there, like you've talked before, He creates the first pattern of the Father Son.
Right. Yeah. Those are the kind of things they want you to start thinking about. Just the logic of it. There's a pattern. And if you see the logic of the pattern, then you begin to understand, the rest of the universe, which follows from that primal pattern. Exactly.
We speak of God's first thought and allude to an impossible time origin of the eternal Son for the purpose of gaining access to the thought channels of the human intellect. Such distortions of language represent our best efforts at contact compromise with the time-bound minds of mortal creatures. In the sequential sense, the Universal Father never could have had a first thought, nor could the Eternal Son have ever had a beginning. But I was instructed to portray the realities of eternity to the time-limited minds of mortals by such symbols of thought, and to designate the relationships of eternity by such time concepts of sequentiality. The Eternal Son is the spiritual personalization of the Paradise Father's universal and infinite concept of divine reality, unqualified spirit, and absolute personality. And thereby does the Son constitute the divine revelation of the creator identity of the Universal Father. The perfect personality of the Son discloses that the Father is actually the eternal and universal source of all the meanings and values of the spiritual, the volitional, the purposeful, and the personal.
Let's stop there a second. Okay, because they're starting to, it's starting to get a little bit denser here, so let's slow it down and see if we can notice a couple things. So unqualified spirit. We often remind ourselves that we have this fundamental parallelism that is going to be set up with the Eternal Son on one side and the Isle of Paradise on the other. And you have that one side that's unqualifiedly energy and the other side that's unqualifiedly spirit. In other words, the body, in the simplest sense, first and foremost, the body of the Eternal Son is not some sort of a blend, homogeneous, heterogeneous, or any other thing you can think of. It's purely spirit substance, period. Not one tiny measure of individuality substance, physical like energy sort of, woven into it or blended into it. Unqualifiedly spirit. That's one of the points he brings up right up front, because that's one of the very most fundamental things to recognize about the Eternal Son. Notice that, he immediately brings up, and thereby does the Son constitute the divine revelation of the Creator identity. You'll see as soon as we start getting into it, we'll come upon that passage that we've referred to a couple times, where they point out that on the one hand, you can call the Son the co-creator, and on the other hand, you can call the Son the coordinate creator, depending upon what's in play, and we'll talk about that. He's pointing out that that's a very fundamental aspect. And then, just think about the wording of this last little bit here. So, that all the meanings and values of the spiritual, volitional, purposeful, and the personal. So, in other words, he's saying, take it from me. I've been there. I've looked at the Eternal Son. Okay, and when you look at the Eternal Son, he says, you see all of the meanings and values of those things. It is, you look at the Eternal Son and you have vast experience and awareness of things, and you don't go, well, he's got everything except. No, okay? It's all the meanings and values of all those spiritually related issues there that he lists up. So he's, because he sees that, and because he knows that the Son is an expression of the Father, he's thinking logically. He follows that back logically. That tells him that the Father, is actually the eternal and universal source of not just some of, but all of. He knows that the Eternal Son comes just from the Father. There's not, Bob over here also feeding into the phenomenon. It's just the Father. And so if you see, everything there, that all has to be, you have to be able to trace that back to a first source and center of all things. Beings, not so much to play, but definitely all those things that he sees, there has to be, it has to be, sourced in the Father.
That's why they also call him Mother's Son, don't they? Something like that.
We haven't gotten to there yet. That's a little bit different. That's coming up. That'll come up really quick, though. That'll come up really quick. But see, just the whole point is, just notice what he does in the preface here. He's got a sentence there that's very purposely constructed to get you trying to say, okay, now why does he think that? Oh, because that's a logical connection. He's setting this up. He wants you to be in, you know, in a more logical mode, because he knows that he's going to try to explain something to you that you don't have any direct experience of. And you won't have any direct, you know, you're not, doesn't matter how spiritual you get, you're not going to walk down the street and suddenly go, aha, I've just seen the eternal sun. That's just not going to happen. Okay. So in order to recognize how this fits into the picture, you've got to have a logical framework that you're thinking in and identifying with the causality in it. So he's trying to foster that. Okay, what else does he do?
To enable the finite mind of time to form some sequential concept of the relationships of the eternal and infinite beings of the Paradise Trinity, we utilize such license of conception as to refer to the Father's first personal, universal, and infinite concept. It is impossible for me to convey to the human mind any adequate idea of the eternal relations of the deities. Therefore, do I employ such terms as will afford the finite mind something of an idea of the relationship of these eternal beings in the subsequent eras of time. We believe the Son sprang from the Father. We are taught that both are unqualifiedly eternal. It is apparent, therefore, that no time creature can ever fully comprehend this mystery of a Son who is derived from the Father and yet who is coordinately eternal with the Father himself.
Okay, so notice he put it in the, you know, in the full frame of spiritual individuals there, not just humans. He put himself in that last sentence. Okay, you know, he's including himself there. He starts out, you know, we believe, you know, the Son's rank from the Father. In other words, you know, they have a logical recognition of the circumstance. You know, that logical consciousness, you know, informs their reasoning mind, and, you know, that logic says we believe that, you know, the Son came from the Father. But then, as he says, but we are taught, you know, he can't, you know, recognize that or deduce that or anything in any way. We are taught that both are unqualifiedly eternal. Okay. So he, you know, he's dependent upon revelation as well. Some things have to be revealed to a divine counselor, and to be revealed to all sub-infinite beings. Part of that revelation is the Son. The Son is a revelation of many things, as we'll, you know, as we read forward, you know, they'll be talking about that. But to see that. You know, he's pointing out that he's trying to give us a starting point as a finite being, just like he had to be given a starting point as a finite being. However, you have something that he doesn't have. Right? You have something that actually has a direct relationship between infinity and the finite. You know, literally, the mind, your finite mind, that's being helped here to form some structures. The adjuster knows, especially, you know, the more experienced adjusters, the adjuster knows how to relate infinity to a definitive finite form in your mind. And that, you know, so if you get something solid there, you may find that over time it does seem to strike you more and more as not so fuzzy. The adjuster will be helping to give it to validate its integrity in your mind. If you ill form it, he's not going to validate it. Okay, but over time, the adjuster will give this positive feedback to that form and encourage you along those lines. You know, and you may find that that form begins to grow and starts to become more than anything that the revelers just gave you very directly. You start to understand a picture that wasn't, that they didn't specify directly in words. You begin to see that, you know, how it all fits together.
I couldn't really conceive of the eternal Son because I was so used to the Creator Son as the eternal, you know, like mm-hmm. the eternal right. Son. So I'm wondering, are you confused at all about the eternal Son?
No.
But he's been sitting here for a long time. You know, it helps. You know, we've talked. You know, we've talked, you know, a lot about it. And there's a bigger concept. It's, you know, I mean, you know, everyone knows. I freely admit, the very first time I read the book, I wasn't finding any resonance with the notion of the eternal Son. I had more resonance with the notion of the infinite Spirit. And I said, so I got the Father, I got this. I, you know, initially the Son didn't seem to have any place to go in my framework. And that was a very immature framework. You know, and then, you know, it's vastly expanded now.
I'm still there.
I mean, it's just
the presence of the gestures in us is the same magnitude of mystery to him.
Yeah.
As what he's describing here.
Right.
Something that came right from the Father, the Son, is also exactly the origin point of the gestures.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that mystery from his point of view of how he as a finite being could possibly understand the infinite. I mean, that mystery is manifest, you know, and the fact that there's an adjuster indwelling our minds, somehow the two are connectable. Okay, so that's how he started us. You know, all in all, I mean, really, there's kind of some basic little fact points and an encouragement towards trying to go beyond, you know, your adjutant thinking. Try to get back and recognize. Try to step back and recognize logically, you know, how the Eternal Son fits into the picture.
One, identity of the Eternal Son. The Eternal Son is the original and only begotten Son of God. He is God the Son, the second person of deity, and the associate creator of all things. As the Father is the first great source and center, so the Eternal Son is the second great source and center.
Okay. See, so Jason, there it is. It's once he gets the preface out of play, and he's kind of in an abstract mode, the very first direct thing that he brings up is that definitive contact point in human religious, you know, history, understanding. You know, the notion of an only begotten Son. You know, that's the first thing he latches onto and says, okay, you know that notion? You have, like, especially if you're a Christian, you probably, you know, been told that many, many times. Only begotten Son, only begotten Son. Okay, let's start there. He says that's our real definitive evolutional, you know, well, in this case, evolutionary. I mean, that evolved, you know, into the notion that only begotten, concept. Okay, and we're going to lock onto that. Now, so, I mean, you know, it's a little bit vague now. I mean, he hasn't really explained in what sense, but of course, you know, that's going to come next. But you know, just, you know, if you just stop and try to think about it, it's like, okay, if you were writing this paper, you're going, okay, what thing can I use in human history to try to connect the Eternal Son to that would, that's something that they already have maybe a firm grip on, and I can try to evolve that forward. You're going to be hard pressed to think of much else besides. You know, the only begotten Son notion is one of the few things that he can lock onto.
Mostly for Judaism and Christianity, that was the first concept. I mean, first fruits. You always gave your
right. I mean, there's. You know, I mean, we all know that this didn't come out of the blue 2,000 years ago. The notion of only begotten Son. You know, there's a very strong history in a lot of religious tradition, a lot of philosophical tradition to have some similar sort of an idea of an archetype, expression of something, you know, that, you know, like no other, this is the distillation of things, you know, only begotten. And you could already tell by bringing up the word, you know, in the preface, you know, a capital W word, you know, the word.
They're off on that.
Right. Right. You know, that whole notion of, you know, sort of the expression. Okay, so what does he say?
The Eternal Son is the spiritual center and the divine administrator of the spiritual government of the universe of universes. The Universal Father is first a creator and then a controller. The Eternal Son is first a co-creator and then a spiritual administrator. God is spirit, and the Son is a personal revelation of that spirit. The first source and center is the volitional absolute. The second source and center is the personality absolute.
Okay. Okay, well, you're going, wait a minute, I was kind of hoping that he'd follow up on the only begotten thing. No, that comes down the ways here a little bit. He's not going to explain himself there yet. He's going to put, you know, he's going to put some other issues in front of us first. You know, and the title of this is The Identity of the Eternal Son. So he's just going to kind of step through some bullet points here. And you notice that paragraph itself was just like all these little bullet points within it. Okay, so the Eternal Son is the spiritual center. And so it's in that sense when you say second source and center, spiritual center, and the divine administrator of the spiritual government. Okay, and we all know, you know, first think of him as a creator, then as a controller, lastly as an infinite upholder. There at the beginning of paper one here, they're reminding us of that. First creator and then controller. And then they say, okay, you can, in kind of parallel to that, you can say co-creator. And then notice they said spiritual administrator. So he, you know, he's breaking a little bit. I mean, now it's also, you can call the Son, the second source and center, you can call the Spirit Controller, I mean, the capital S, capital Z, the Spirit Controller. You know, they told us that way up in the foreword, that's a usable proper designation. A valid proper designation for the Eternal Son. But he didn't bring that up here. So, you know, that more technical thing of a spirit controller, he doesn't want to bring in first. He's saying, I mean, in terms of your initial recognition of the Son, trying to understand how he fits in, just think of those two things first. You're going to need a co-creator, and he's going to talk about that, why you need a co-creator. And then you're going to need a spiritual administrator. You're going to need someone in the universe that's behind all of the administration of spiritual issues in the universe. So he's saying, start with those two notions of understanding where the Eternal Son fits in. Okay, and then this, you know, is extremely important, this last statement, okay? This is where you really can begin to get a very revelatory, transformational idea in your mind going about the nature of the Universal Father, when you can bring in this distinction between the Father and the Son. Okay, the second source and center is the personality absolute. Okay, in the sense of each of us in this room is a relative personality. In one way, you're someone's relative. Okay? You're related to someone. Okay? But in a more technical sense, you're not an unqualified fact. For instance, when we talked about personality back in the previous paper, you know, they every time they mentioned free will, they stuck relatively in front of it to remind you that as a personality, you know, and one of those definitive things that you get, free will with that personality, it's relative. What's the relativity of it? It's only in one sense that you have absolute free will, the choice of eternity or not. Everything else, okay, is relative. You know, in other words, someone can supersede you. You can say, I want to do such and so, and someone above you says no. And there's nothing you can do about it. You're overruled. Okay? You are a relative personality. You're a relative expression of free will. You are
an eternal fact, not just a temporal fact.
Yeah. Yeah. And
not going to help.
Right. Now, obviously, you know this. Your scope does expand, but when you're thinking about that relative personality that you have, okay, logically, there is no such thing as even the notion of relative in the absence of an absolute. I mean, everything that's quote unquote relative has to be relative to the absolute, to some absolute thing, to some non-relative thing. Like, you know, when we talk about the Isle of Paradise, it's not, you know, it's the only thing in the universe that's not in motion. You know, if it's a universe of motion, well, in motion relative to what? You know, there has to be at least one thing that's not in motion. Okay? The relativity of your the limitations of your personality are relative to the unlimited, absolute personality.
Playing devil's advocate, why can't everything be in motion relative to everything else?
No,
I mean, that's the question that kind of right. Going on all
right
in my mind.
Right.
Why does it have to be relative to something that's not moving?
Just take something simple. The basic things that you think about when scientists will talk to you about relativity. You know, not necessarily special relativity, but just relativity. You're driving along, in the train, riding along in the train, and the tracks are perfect. Okay, it's just as smooth as silk, these tracks and these wheels. Okay. And you're looking out, and you're watching the scenery go by, and then you go, wait a minute. I'm assuming that I'm moving, and the scenery is stationary. How do I know I'm not stationary, and the scenery's moving? When you start thinking about that relativity, and it's like, well, but wait a minute. How do I know anything? I mean, how could anything be moving?
You don't realize you've let the foot off the brake.
Right. I mean, the thing that you begin to discover as you try to investigate things like motion is nothing makes sense unless there's an absolute frame of reference somehow.
Right. You can't sort out what's truly moving.
Right. It all is it can't be logical without an absolute. An absolute is an essential for a logical structure. I mean, the simple example of with special theory of relativity, this notion that you calculate these equations that describe the relativity of motions, but in order to derive those equations, you have to assume that there's one thing that's not relative. A motion that's not relative, the speed of light. See, I mean, that's just a simple mathematical example. You can't derive those equations of the relativity of things without something that's not relative. At least,
you've got to pick a point.
Relatively not relative. You know, it's not absolute, but it's an absolute. It's transfinite. Yeah. So,
can't you have a relativity to the whole?
Well, you do. I mean, there's lots of relativity to the whole. But, I mean, the whole point is that as you try to logically put this together, there has to be an absolute. There has to be something that everything is relative to. Now, the whole reason for starting the discussion of reality with seven absolutes of infinity is as an initial way of having a logical picture where you're going, well, if I've got this thing, if I've got spirit, it has to be relative to something. Where's the spirit absolute? Oh, that's the eternal sun. Well, I've got this thing called mind. Well, if I've got this mind thing, it's got to be relative to something. You know, where is it? Oh, you know. So the very first things that you think of where there needs to be something that this is all anchored relative to, you know, you can point to it. Eternal sun, conjoint actor, Isle of Paradise, whatever, you know. Let's just leave it at that. I mean, it's just recognize. Okay, so now back to this, the personality absolute. So, Father gives you a personality, and you say, I am. You know, it's existential recognition that you get from that I am fact, the Father. I am. Okay, that recognition is relative to what? That simple existential recognition, is it relative to the Father? No. It's relative to the personality absolute. It's relative to the Son. That relativity of recognition is tied to the personality absolute. See, the second source and center is the point that you're recognizing a relativity to. The Father is the volitional absolute. When you actually, when you go beyond just this individuation of will and its existence relative to something, when you start to exercise that will, volition, okay, what is that volition relative to? It's not relative to the Son. That's relative to the Father. The Father is the volitional absolute. It's His personality circuit that volition is flowing in. He's the anchor point for the exercise of will. But just the existential fact of will, not yet exercised, just its existence, that's a point of existential deity called the Son that's relative to. The Father handed off that. He doesn't possess that anchor point anymore. He handed that anchor point to the Son. So as an existential fact, it's that existential deity that you're relative. Once it's exercising, now there's a relativity. Okay, so that's the distinction, and just reflecting on the difference. Think about how that's a challenge to anyone historically. That should make you feel a little uncomfortable if you have any sort of theology about personality and will and all this. That it's like, wait a minute, I don't want the Son to have that. I want the Father to have that. I'm going to reject that. they're saying, no, the Father had the courage to hand it to the Son. You can probably have the courage to identify with the Son as well in that regard.
Welcome to relative free will. You can't change that.
Right.
Once you recognize what the Father is looping with you with, that's incredible. You're going to start to be a point in the universe that is doing something.
Notice how he's the initiator. The Father needs to be the initiator. He needs to have freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. If he tried to hold both the personality absolute and the volitional absolute anchor at the same time, there couldn't be a volitional absolute, because that stasis of existentialness would freeze it solid. There would be no flow in a personality circuit.
Okay.
He liberated himself so that he could flow and you could flow with him. So he could initiate you, not just the beingness, but the doingness.
Yeah. Good reason for his liberating.
Yeah. You can immediately imagine if I put those two together, there's not going to be a room for anything else. There's just going to be God the infinite, period, The I am made God. You have to break these things that are locking down the Father.
He already did that.
And also locking down us too.
Right. There's just so many things that you can begin to think about once you see it like this, about how this affects, the way you see yourself. You immediately challenges you to get off that initial mark. One must do something as well as be something. But so many religionists are stuck. And if anything, the fact that they said, what you're stuck relative to is the eternal Son. And how you really don't care about the eternal Son? You want everything to be about the Father? Well, if nothing else, let that motivate you to think differently. The son won't be offended. Don't worry. You'll finally get back around to him. But, they're trying to liberate the concept of the Father, too, from the shackles of our, immature notions. Okay.
The universal Father never personally functions as a creator, except in conjunction with the Son or with the coordinate action of the Son. Had the New Testament writer referred to the eternal Son, he would have uttered the truth when he wrote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made."
Okay. Does everyone know where that comes from?
John.
John.
Gospel of John.
John chapter 1, verses 1 and 3. Yep.
I thought Genesis said that in the very beginning.
No, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Not in the beginning was the Word. That's the beginning of the Gospel of John. And are we surprised that the Divine Counselor is quoting John? No, John. He loves to quote John. He's been quoting John for papers already. John, you know, the words of the Apostle John are used extensively by the Divine Counselor and many other the authors too. Okay, so here's that sentence. This is the one key spot in the book that gives you a real challenge to clarify a thought in your head. The Universal Father never personally functions as a creator except, okay, when the Father is functioning as a creator, you know, technically what do we call that? We call that the Universal Creator. You know, you have the whole circuit of the Father. It's not the first center, it's not the first source. It's, you know, it's not directly the Universal Father or the Universal Controller or the Infinite Upholder. It's the Universal Creator. Okay, so if the Father is going to be in a mode where, if you want to be really precise here, not just kind of blurring everything all together into the Universal Father as an individuality viewpoint, if you want to spread it out and get the real deity viewpoint going, and you've got, okay, so when does the Father function as the Universal Creator? Okay, never except in conjunction with the Son or with the coordinate action of the Son. Okay, two things, an or, okay? Because there's an or there, it'd be nice if we had two proper designations for the Son to indicate which mode the Son is in. If the Son is working with the Father, which mode is he in? Mode number one or mode number two? If he's in the mode where it's just in conjunction with the Son, that's the, capital C, co-creator. The co-creator. And that mode is essentially to create Havona, to create the central universe. Okay. That's the co-creator mode of the Eternal Son, to get the central universe into existence. By and large, subsequent to that, if you have the Father functioning as a creator, as the universal creator, for instance, to make a creator Son, the Son is not in his mode as the co-creator. The Son is in his mode as the coordinate creator. See that? Or with the coordinate action of the Son. And that's a mother word. Exactly. All right. So the capital C, you know, the coordinate creator. that's not so much referring to the eternal Son. That's the eternal mother Son. Okay. If the Son is in a creation mode, where you really have that basic dual phenomenon that is appropriately understood as Father-Mother, okay, then you have the coordinate creator. Then you have the eternal Mother-Son.
Where does the name on the ellipse go that one? Mother aspect.
Well, you know, if you look, you have the eternal Mother-Son right here, you know, in the circuit of the Mother. Okay. Yeah, it's in that domain where you have the Son. Okay, just the eternal Mother Son. I mean, that's the, you know, we'll talk about that as we go forward here with the Son. But you have not just the Son type deity, you have the Mother type deity bonded with it. You know, you have the Mother Son hyphen the Mother Son type deity personalized as the, you know, and that personalization, when you think of it as an individual, you call that the eternal Mother Son.
So the volitional universal Father, he's just volition, but the Son is actually taking the will from the Father and doing
it. Well, just, I mean, the personality of the Son is not unlike the personality each of us is bestowed. You have the reservoir of all will. The Father reaches into it, individuates out of measure, and bestows it.
He's doing the pure will of the Father, the eternal Son.
Well, I mean, this thing about the personality absolute, in terms of dipping a measure out of the reservoir and personalizing something, there's only one measure of that total will that can be ladled out and put on a purely spirit fact and have it be an absolute fact. There's just one absolute individuation of will bestowed on a pure spirit fact, and that's the eternal Son. Okay? So the eternal Son has will, and so do we. It's just that his will is absolute and ours is relative. Okay? But it's the same, it's individuated will. It's been taken out of the reservoir and bestowed.
But it's perfect will.
As a potential, your will is perfect too. As a potential, and from an eternity viewpoint where the Son is, there's no difference between potential and actual. I mean, it is, innately divine. You have potential divinity, not actual divinity, not even close. It's coming from a divine source. It's not like somehow, when you think about it, just sort of as it is, the Father measures it out and hands it out. It's not like somehow as he's moving his hand, it's degrading in quality so that when he drops on you, it's a blob of goo, It's going to be divine. It can't be anything but divine. He can't hold anything except that which is divine. It has to be understood in some way, logically, it has to be divine. You're going, it doesn't make sense to think of it as actually divine. Oh, yeah, sure. It's a reservoir of potential. He's not changing it. He's just ladling out a measure of potential, giving me a measure of potential. And that potential is divine. Now, and associated with that measure of potential divinity is a free will to actualize it over time. Your choice. If you choose not to actualize it, it's not like its potential divinity is diminished. It's still potentially divine. And if you're not going to be the means by which that purposing gets actualized, it's going to go somewhere else. We know where it's going to go. It's going to go to God the Almighty. That potential divinity will be actualized. Nothing can change that. It's just that God has given you the incredible opportunity to participate in its actualization. Your choice. In the beginning was the Word. Here's a little bit of the only begotten Son, but only kind of indirectly. We know that when John is writing that, he's thinking of Jesus. And like the divine counselor said, if the New Testament writer, i.e. John, Nathan writing for John, had referred to the eternal Son instead of Jesus, it would have been a distinct measure of truth there. All right.
When a son of the eternal Son appeared on your rancho, those who fraternized with this divine being in human form alluded to him as, quote, he who was from the beginning, whom we have heard, whom we have seen with our eyes, whom we have looked upon, and our hands have handled, even the word of life. And this bestowal Son came forth from the Father, just as truly as did the original Son, as is suggested in one of his earthly prayers. And now, O my Father, glorify me with your own self, with the glory which I had with you before this world was.
Okay, the last quote is again from the Gospel of John. And like the Divine Counselor so often does, if he gives you a quote from the Gospel of John, he very frequently also gives you a quote from the first epistle of John. And that's what the other one is. He who was from the beginning, that's the very beginning of first John, you know, the first epistle of John. Which, remember from, you know, they tell you up in the beginning of the Jesus papers, First John was the covering letter for, you know, what's come to be known as the Gospel of John. And that letter was literally written by John himself, not written for John, like the Gospel was. So he's just doing what he always does. He's quoting from John, both First John and the Gospel of John. And
that last quote, yep, that she just finished mm-hmm. up with, mm-hmm. that's Jesus in the garden, Gethsemane.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, quite a ways into, way up 17th chapter or something like that. And you notice he's, you know, between the lines, he's playing off of this only begotten thing. He's trying to, you know, remind you, you kind of know what this is about. All you need to do is just take it to infinity and in eternity instead of trying to rationalize it down in time as Jesus. Yeah.
The eternal Son is known by different names in various universes. In the central universe, he is known as the coordinate source, the co-creator, and the associate absolute. On Uversa, the headquarters of the super universe, we designate the Son as the coordinate spirit center and as the eternal spirit administrator. On Salvington, the headquarters of your local universe, this Son is of record as the second eternal source and center. The Melchizedeks speak of him as the Son of Sons. On your world, but not in your system of inhabited spheres, this original Son has been confused with a coordinate creator Son, Michael of Nebadon, who bestowed himself upon the mortal races of Urantia.
Okay. Let's logically see why they, you know, some of these use these different designations. Okay, so known by different names. So in the central universe, he is known as the coordinate source, the co-creator, and the absolute associate. The absolute associate is, you know, okay, that's not too complicated to understand. So why would the central universe be so inclined to think of the second source of center by those first two? Well, like I already mentioned, I mean, they know who created them and the universe that they live in. The universal creator, along with the Son acting as the co-creator. So they call him the co-creator. Okay. They also know that that experiential deity that the eternal Son, the existential fact, acquired, where did the eternal Son get that experiential deity experience?
In Havona.
In Havona. Right? They know that that there's a coordinate source, a mother source nature to the eternal Son that was gained in relationship to them and their universe. So they you know, that's how they designate the Son. See, so coordinate source and co-creator. Now on Uversa, the headquarters of the super universe, we designate the Son as the coordinate spirit center and the eternal spirit administrator. Well, again, okay. You might notice that out here, both of them have the word spirit in, because out here, it's very much, the Son manifests as a spirit presence. Okay? And so they emphasize that there's a spirit presence among us. And they see it in two different ways. they see it in that administrator mode. They know that there's all this administration, spiritual administration going on, and, you know, it all goes back, you know, to that individual. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. You know, especially on Universa, where it's the administrative headquarters of the super universe, and okay, it's all pretty logical. And notice how, okay, now they also have coordinate, but it's not coordinate source, it's coordinate center. Okay, you're moving out. You start with coordinate source, and then you add center onto that. So it's coordinate center and source. Remember, we talked about that. Which order are they in? You know, are we talking about a source center or a center source? Which is the foundation, the source part or the center part? With, you know, with the Father, the foundation of the Father is in the first center. Okay, the Father is a source center. Foundation is center, and source is tacked onto that. We know that all the stuff coming from the Trinity, the mother side, is flipped around. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. Notice this is exactly, see, I mean, it's source, and then center is a designation that's added to that. It's foundationally down there in the core of everything, source. And then center is added to that. See, even that, is reflective of, we're talking about the mother aspect here, this coordinate aspect. We're talking about a center source, not a source center. Yeah.
To go back a step, I think you often refer to the Father and the Eternal Son as co-creators of paradise.
Yeah, paradise and, I mean, Havona. I mean, the paradise part, you know, that's a little bit abstract. It's, you know, more easy to understand the, you know, the creation of the central universe itself. But technically, paradise is in that co-creator mode as well. Yeah.
Did we get the associate absolute?
Well, I just mentioned. I mean, they're just here. Actually, just notice. You know, the thing about the Son of Sons. That's kind of like the absolute of absolutes, a reflection of that. I mean, there's always this recognition of the absolute of absolutes thing in play. And so when you're just, you know, thinking about sort of the logical arrangement of those absolutes, a way of kind of appreciating them coming into existence, you know, when you're talking about the beings, you know, you're just like we have a universal creator and a co-creator, and then gives rise to the conjoint creator. You have that sequence. It's like, okay, well, we start with, you know, sort of the absolute in a sense, you know, sort of that first absolute, and then we have an associate absolute, and that's going to give rise to a conjoint absolute. You know, and one of the things that's in play with that. Remember how we talked about if you follow the Father back and you get that, your initial recognition really only, or you know, you shouldn't say recognition, your initial sort of vision of it, how you begin, you know, initially sort of understand, see the Father is back to the universal Father. But then you logically begin to recognize there has to be this first source and this first center behind that. If you take that, if you extend it back to here, you call that part of it the Father Absolute. You know, it's right there next to it's in the level where the Absolute is. If you take it all the way back here, that's the Father Infinite. The recognition that the Father extends all the way back to that root that's in relationship to the Infinite. So, see, in that sense, you have a recognition of the Father Absolute, and then you have the Associate Absolute, and then Conjoint Absolute. See, so that's kind of how that fits into that. Yeah.
The Lord of Lords and King of Kings was mm-hmm. something that was attached to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, if we can learn through Jesus who the Eternal Son was, then it could be a positive.
Right. And then just the basic recognition that there's a number of parallels, you know, of humans using that form of expression, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. that's, you know, it's in that spirit that they say absolute of absolutes. You know, that's, they're tying into that basic mode of expressing that, see, even if you start thinking about, logically, about an absolute for matter and an absolute for spirit and an absolute for mind, etc., well, okay, logically, in order for me to be able to think about some differential in absolutes, you know, there's a qualified aspect there. Well, there has to be some unqualified. There has to be an absolute for those absolutes, just like there, each of them is an absolute for all the relatives of energy or matter, or, I mean, for energy or spirit or whatever. Okay, so, I mean, humans have that logical sense. You mean, there may be lords, but if there's lords, there has to be a lord of lords. Or where would, you know, the multiplicity, the distinguishing aspects of these different lords come from? How could that qualification exist without some unqualified lordship behind that, those qualified expressions? See, so it's always a logical thing. Logic is always driving you back to the first source and center of all things and beings, no matter what you're following back.
So is it inaccurate to refer to the eternal sun as the second source and center?
No. Of course they do. As an existential fact.
Okay.
See? Existentially, you have a first source and center, second source and center, third source and center. I mean, and a paradise source and center.
But not as a mother son.
Right. When you bring in that, when you're thinking about that, you know, or the infinite mother spirit, when you're bringing in the mother, the experiential deity, okay, that's a different picture. Okay. You know, and one of the ways that comes in here is, you know, writing down the creators and the controllers of the sevenfold, but then recognizing if I want to start really thinking about how the whole picture is there, I have to have another column that has the eternal mother son and the infinite mother spirit. You know, I have to have a column of downstepped expression of the mother in order to have the whole picture. You know, and of course there's no schizophrenia between the eternal mother son and the eternal son, but it's just, you know, you have to recognize, you know, you take it one step at a time. First you go, okay, there's existential deity. And the way that works is there's an overarching facet of deity over the whole existential side of the equation. You know, the Father. And immediately under the Father is the Son, the Spirit, and the Isle. And that's existential deity. And then on the other side, I have experiential deity. And the mother overarches that. And there's three immediate sub-expressions. You know, the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute. And so, bringing in the mother part of the eternal mother son and the infinite mother spirit is just noticing it's not as simple as that initial picture would indicate. You know, it's not like you create these two branches. You know, you start with the infinite and you break it into the father and the mother, and these two branches go down and never talk to each other again. You know, and you've got these parallel two parallel universes. No, that's not the way it works. I mean, the very first step down, you know, I mean, there's mother deity that gets bonded into the Son and the Spirit. Yeah, so, I mean, it's very complex. But to, right, I mean, so, you can't think about it simplistically, but you definitely, you know, you need to start with the foundational things and then recognize how it begins to then interplay. You can't start with it all in the, you know, accomplish gobbledygook and then try to understand something. You know, there's no way to understand if it's all blended together. You got to separate it apart and then think about how it starts to come together. Okay, and it's very much, there's no violation of the truth of it. In terms of a causal logical understanding of the eternal mother son, like I said, it's mother deity tacked on to son deity, not son deity tacked on to mother deity. You know, you start with an existential foundation. You know, and then experiential nature is added to that. I mean, the son has to exist before he can go to paradise. I mean, before he can go to Havona and have experiences. Existential has to come before experiential. Yeah. And even if it's not a time sequence, it's still a logical, you know, arrangement.
In entering Havona, he crossed over into time.
Well, we'll get to that later in these Eternal Sun pages. He didn't really do it like that because he couldn't.
Yeah,
okay. And if you remember, the first Creator Son is a key to this. The first Creator Son is different than the others. The first Creator Son is tied to this experiential fact of the Son in Havona and really makes that a direct expression in the time, if you will, of Havona. It's not as simple as, it's not like the Eternal Son, you know, became flesh and walked around on the Havona worlds.
Right.
That's not the way it worked.
Right. There's this tendency to just regard Havona as a time domain.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, right. I mean, you know, the easiest way to start thinking about it is this, there's the absoluteness of paradise and the finiteness of the super universe level, and then there's an absoluteness in between that is Havona. But even that's a little bit, you know, of a distortion. But it's at least a beginning, you know. So that the experiences the son had in Havona, the eternal son had in Havona, is just a completely transcendent experience. Mm-hmm. It's really incomprehensible even to the authors. But it was a literal experience nonetheless. He had some sort of an experiential engagement of the whole of Havona. He wasn't just there existing as an existential presence over Havona, sort of. I mean, he somehow got into it, you know, in some way that no one understands. Okay. Now, and part of the way he did it not only was via this first Creator Son, but also the Infinite Spirit getting experience and becoming the Infinite Mother Spirit is, you know, coordinate with this as well. It all happens together to make it happen.
And that's why I just can't get comfortable with just deciding that Havona is a domain of time.
Right. No, I mean, at the very least, like John said, I mean, you ought to think of it as, you know, as transcended time or something like that. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, let's not belabor it too much here. But okay, so then that last little bit there.
Although any of the paradise sons may fittingly be called sons of God, we are in the habit of reserving the designation, the eternal son, for this original son, the second source and center, co-creator of the universal
with
the universal father of the central universe of power and perfection, and co-creator of all other divine sons who spring from the infinite deities.
Okay, so one little technicality there. Like I said, I mean, you would call him the coordinate creator when he and the father are making a creator son. You know, in the sort of a universal father, universal mother sense there. But notice that, you know, they use co-creator here. Why didn't they say coordinate creator? Because they're not just talking about creator sons. They've generalized it, so they don't want to use that specific term. When the eternal son and the infinite spirit are giving rise to a magisterial son, are creating a magisterial son, it's not appropriate to think of that dual creative phenomenon and, you know, as really a father-mother like sort of duality, universal creator, coordinate creator. So, I mean, if you wanted to talk, you know, give a creator label to the son in that mode, you'd have to say that the co-creator is working with the conjoint creator to make a magisterial son. Yeah. But I would be disinclined really to do that. It'd be more just keep it out. Really the best place to use the proper designation of capital C co-creator is what they said first there, creating the central universe. That by and large, that's when you're really, you're thinking about the sun in a mode where really that's all that's going on. And you really want to just take that fact of co-creation and personify it into a proper noun and say, not only is he co-creating, he is the, he is the co-creator. When the Eternal Son is making magisterial sons, I mean, that's in the context of all kinds of other things going on and whatnot. It's, you're not envisioning that, there's nothing in the universe except the universal creator and the co-creator, and then they're going to make the first thing, So it wouldn't be really that appropriate to use that proper designation there. But you, as an uncapitalized thing, you don't want to say coordinate creator there, because the magisterial sons are in play. They're a divine son also. Okay, so there's all kinds of, like they said, sometimes we got to kind of use words, a little bit of flexibility because there's only so many words. Okay, so, it's up to us to recognize the foundational use of the words and then see how sometimes they have to be fudged a tad just so that, it's not... right. Let's get the nature here, because then we'll get a little bit more on the whole bit about the only begotten here.
2, nature of the Eternal Son. The Eternal Son is just as changeless and infinitely dependable as the Universal Father. He is also just as spiritual as the Father, just as truly an unlimited spirit. To you of lowly origin, the Son would appear to be more personal, since he is one step nearer you in approachability than is the Universal Father. The Eternal Son is the eternal Word of God. He is wholly like the Father. In fact, the Eternal Son is God the Father, personally manifest to the universe of universes. And thus it was and is and forever will be, true of the Eternal Son and of all the coordinate Creator Sons. He who has seen the Son has seen the Father.
Okay, now let's think about what he's bringing up there. Because there's some potential confusion, we're getting towards the more distortion of meaning. Let's try not to let that happen any more than we have to. So they start with, to you of lowly origin, the Son would appear to be more personal since he is one step nearer you in approachability. Now, we all know that there's sort of a direct expression of that on the Isle of Paradise. You get to the Isle of Paradise, and you have the deity presence as the center. The Father's in the center, enshrouded by the Son, enshrouded by the Spirit. So to penetrate to a direct personal engagement, the Father, you have to go through the Spirit and through the Son, and you learned how to do that as you were working through Havona. First you recognized the Infinite Spirit, and then the Eternal Son, and then the Universal Father. Yeah. And you use that, that what you learned how to do in Havona when you get to Paradise in order to. So they're just reminding you this is true in general. And that's kind of related to the personality absolute, volitional absolute. I mean, it's just an immediate personality fact. This purposing that's engaged a self, and made this individual. The first thing that you're going to find in the universe there up on high, that is very definitively like that, is the Eternal Son. The personality of the Father is subtler, and basically that's because the Son is, like I said, is not unlike you. The Son is, even though he's an infinite personality, it's still its individuated will. the Father's unindividuated will, which is, is not really technically a personality at all. That's why they say, well, you know, if you want to be specific, he's a Father personality, not a personality. Okay, because, you know, or at the very least, you know that the universal Father is self-personalized. Okay, so, you know, yeah, kind of individuated, but not completely, because it comes right back again. So, yeah.
It says here, the Father is like one step beyond that with the
right.
volitional circuit. It's
right.
the volitional absolute.
Right.
And that's almost like it's a step into that impersonal zone again. So it's kind of backs off that personality. And that's kind of where the adjuster is, too. You know?
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
And they kind of work together.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just the what they're trying to get you to start to think about is that real, absolute focus point fact is the sun. That which is much more of a dynamic thing, that's the Father. And that's why I'm saying, see, we don't even really currently have the language to express this. And that's why I coined that word. It's just a slight little addition to previous coinage. But we have essence. Okay, that beingness. Okay, that's what they're saying. Okay, that's the Son. The Father's something different. I mean, and so, and when I first recognized that, it's like, we need a word that describes not the essence. It's like essence, but not, so static. Okay, and that's
patience,
the doingness, using that facera, the Latin verb to do rather than the Latin verb to be instead of essa. Okay, so you have, so you can think of, in this mode of comparison, you have an essence on the one hand and a patience on the other hand. Or if you're just thinking about personality and, will and volition, you have the same thing. Will, it's an essence of that reservoir, okay? It's this potential, it's just this beingness, okay? But the exercise of the will, volition, see, that's a patience. That's a doingness, not just a beingness.
And to self-personalize, nothing's going to do that but something that's, dynamic beyond.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's so dynamic that it can transcend itself. Right. Yep. See.
But when they refer to the second source and center as a personality absolute,
right?
Then that is a little bit confusing about the the personality circuit that we have with the first source.
Right. And that's why I've been kind of trying to clear this up. The personality that the second source and center has, that the eternal Son has, that personality was bestowed upon him by the Father. Okay, so it's just like you and I are trying to understand about ourselves. Okay, there's a reservoir of will. A measure was taken out and bestowed. The eternal Son had that same thing happen to him, just like it happened to everyone in the room here. Personality was bestowed on that self. Okay, but it's different to the Father.
The Father doesn't want to just slam down our ego. He respects our ego. And it allows the ego to be the king here, at least temporarily, at least in the finite, and to make these and to choose,
Right.
To recognize first.
Yeah, that ego, that self, is being given an amazing measure of liberty that beings all over the universe puzzle over. I mean, you gave that self even a measure of free will, relative free will. I mean, are you sure about that? Is that really a wise thing to do? But it's tied to what you're saying. I mean, there has to be a literal separation. You that self has to have a measure of separateness so that it truly, really can choose eternity. You know, and it's all just a down, that all comes down from that whole initial him freeing himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. You know, him pulling back and allowing us to be. You know, not letting it all be locked onto his one fact. You know, and if you draw back like that, then this has the potential not to just be separate from it, but to break up into an infinite number of fact points. You know, he let go of the thing that prevents it from being one fact. That means it can only be one thing, an infinite number of facts. It just, it breaks into a million points of light, quote unquote, you know, an infinite number of points.
He was the secret of there being the ability to be other, and that was the.
Yeah. It, you always have that. I mean, it's either one or infinite, yeah. You know, and the fact that he said it's not going to be one, it means it's an infinite. So you inexorably are going to have an infinite number of things and beings as a consequence of him, you know, and really the him is kind of pre him. You know, it's not being one fact, God the infinite, you know, but instead saying no. That kind of thing is going to be outside, and that's going to be me. That's God the Father. And then the deity, you know, that remains within is God the Mother, and it's not a thing that wants to, you know, lock like that. It wants to just hold what has been let go of. Yeah. And now you have the Father and the Mother. Okay?
That is one side of how much God loves us.
He loves you enough to give you free will, you know, and all the other words that you can think of that go with it, like trust and that's part of what they're getting at. You know, the more that you get a really definitive picture in play, the more you will just be moved within at the recognition of what God has done for you. When it's no longer magical picture in your head anymore, when you're starting to think about it very literally and logically, it really starts to sink in just exactly what's going on here and how amazing you are as a fact, you know, as it's from the beneficence of God. By grace alone, look what he's done. Yeah. Okay, so now this whole issue, he who has seen the Son has seen the Father. You know, when we're talking about a creator Son, we've talked about that a lot. That's a very direct, literal, easy thing to understand, okay? You know, to make a creator Son, you take a little measure of the Father-type deity and a little measure of the Son-type deity from the two parents, and you stick it together, and you personalize it. You lock it together as a personalization of deity as a God. Okay, so, I mean, it's very, you know, I mean, obviously the Creator Son can say, he who has seen me has seen the Father. I mean, he literally has a measure of Father-type deity in his being. Okay, it's not quite the same with the Son. The Son is just purely the Son-type deity. Okay, but there's another sense. See, for the Eternal Son is special. Like you're saying, he is the one. There's that only begotten word, that one absolute expression that doesn't need to be downstepped as an individuation or anything like that. There's just one pure, direct, absolute expression of the word of the Father, and that's the Eternal Son. So it's true for both of them that he who has seen the Son has seen the Father, but in a slightly different way of understanding how that is. One, you're talking about right at the Father's level. Now, to get down below the Father's level, you're going to have to take something and downstep and put it down there. Okay, and that's a Creator Son. But right there at that absolute level, the Father absolute, you know, the thought God made Word God. Okay. It's, you know, that direct channel. That's the way in which you see the Son, you see the Father. You know, and like they're just pointing out, that primary thing is, as a personalized spirit fact, you know, if you want to know what the Father looks like when he expresses himself as a personalized spirit fact, look to the Son. That's what that looks like. You can't, you know, and it's all you have to do is just get to recognize that that's not just a face. It's literally, there's literally a separate being there. But in spite of the fact that there's a separation, the Father divested himself of that face, you know, to a degree. It still is, there is nothing that is fuzzing the linkage. It's an absolutely pure, individuated face expression of the Father at the absolute level. Okay? All right.
In nature, the Son is wholly like the Spirit Father. When we worship the Universal Father, actually we at the same time worship God the Son and God the Spirit. God the Son is just as divinely real and eternal in nature as God the Father.
Okay. Now this combines with a little chunk that I skipped over in the previous ones. I wanted to do these two together. When they say that the Eternal Son is God the Father, you know, parenthetically, personally manifest in the universe of universes, okay, that qualification is God the Father. And then notice how, you know, combine that with what they just said here, you know, bringing in worship. Remember back in the previous paper when we talked about worship and prayer? You remember how that summation statement goes? A number of you, I think, do. You know, we worship God, pray to, you know, it just says God. We worship God. We pray and commune with the Son. Okay, remember that? We worship God. Okay. It's one thing when we're in the individuality point of view here, and we have, here's the Universal Father, here's the Eternal Son, here's the Infinite Spirit or the Conjoint Actor. And, but, you know, we're not worshiping an individuation, really, if you think about it. I mean, that worship is connected to the, you know, the unity, the harmony of the cosmos. You're worshiping the wholeness of it all and how transcendently glorious that is. I mean, worship is identifying with that unity. And you really need to put yourself in a unity viewpoint where there just is God. We worship God. Okay, now technically, you know, that, yeah, right. Technically, that God, you know, in this unity point of view, yes, it's one in the unity point of view, but there's faces, there's facets in the unity point of view. One of those facets is called God the Father, one is called God the Son, one's called God the Spirit, one's called God the Mother, God the Sevenfold, etc. Okay. You know, in that full unity sense that is the truest of worship, we worship God, period. The unity that is God. Face is irrelevant. Okay. So there. See, and then they're putting those together. See, I mean, even in a more direct sense, you can appreciate that. I mean, God is one, and so there has to be some way of understanding that when you see God the Son, you are seeing God the Father and God the. I mean, you're seeing God. Yeah, you're seeing God. You're seeing personalized deity. And the fundamental quality of deity is unity. Okay, see, so it's just, and then, see, so there's just that basic, and then you go, well, yes, but I'm trying to get a little bit more of a detailed understanding, and I now know that when I look in the unity viewpoint, I still have faces of this singular thing I'm thinking of, and that's why it has the parenthetical. The Eternal Son is God the Father, personally manifest the universe of unity, not impersonally or, you know, any other thing you might think of. Okay. It's the personally manifest face of God. And then there's the volitionally manifest phase, you know, the initiator manifest, you know, manifested phase, etc. You know, there's all these different, you know.
The infinity.
Right, all these other things that we could talk about. But, see, okay, so, so that, I mean, you just notice that really to kind of pull these statements apart, we do have to have kind of this whole picture that we've developed. You know, you just wouldn't, we wouldn't have the language to even start thinking about this well if we didn't really have the individuality view and the unity viewpoint separate and we could distinguish. You know, we know that when they say God, the whatever, that's the unity viewpoint designation, not the individuality viewpoint designation. The eternal Son, that's an individuality viewpoint designation. So, I mean, they mix them together, but in the, you know, the, they purposely are mixing them together so that when you've gotten this in your head, you can, you know, they're trying to remind you, remember, you know, if you look at it this way, it's one thing. If you look at it this way, it's another thing. They've got them both in place so that you can try to hold both viewpoints in your head simultaneously, like they keep telling us we need to do in order to really understand this. Okay.
I'm just thinking about this, that for people who only have the Bible for their instruction, and with the confusion between Jesus and the Eternal Son, wouldn't that cause a lot of difficulty in conceptualizing the Trinity?
Extremely difficult, yeah. I mean, two things that immediately result from making the other two persons of the, you know, the Trinity of Christendom, you know, Jesus and then some sort of vague Holy Spirit notion, which doesn't even seem to be a person.
Yeah, I see that. Right. People really confuse the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, not to, you know, and forget about the infinite Spirit, you know, or anything else. Right. So, I mean, two big things that does immediately. One, there's no way you're ever going to actually recognize the fact that is the Paradise Trinity, that fourth fact that's on the same level as the three persons, you know, because unconsciously, you know there's a differential in your thinking between this thing you're calling the Universal Father and Jesus. You know, but it's like, well, not, you know, yeah, there is this Trinity, but you know it's not a Trinity all on the same level. And so it really just immediately breaks the potential. You know, if I put them all together, it's like, well, they're all on the same level. They're meeting. There's going to be some super additive consequence to that meeting of nature, on a common level. So you can't. You know, there's just no way to sort of logically get that super additive consequence that is the Paradise Trinity as a fourth fact. It's just going to be a name. You know, a designation for a triad. Okay, we know that, but the other thing that perhaps is even more corrosive, because that's kind of getting more into philosophy, but more corrosive to you as a recognition of who you are and who God is. If you say that an obvious, very finite fact, Jesus, and some vague, fuzzy, finite ministry, the Holy Spirit, are sort of... in direct linkage to a thing you're going to call the Universal Father, what becomes of your notion of the Universal Father? You have no choice but to drag the Father down.
That was more anthropomorphic.
To that level. You know? Right. You know,
even though it's a high moral level.
I mean, you basically have the anthropomorphic Old Testament Universal Father, you know, in some sort of, you know, strange combination triad with Jesus and a fuzzy spirit ministry. Okay? I mean, you just drag the whole notion down by putting Jesus and the Holy Spirit, you know, into the mix. By following those two things back up to their sources, the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit, you allow the Father to rise above his anthropomorphism in your mind. The Father will rise with your efforts to seek the sources of those other two. And you'll finally begin to have a Father that is worthy of the thought of being a universal Father, something that could be a Father of all things, not only seen, but unseen. How could an anthropomorphism be the father of things unseen? It looks like what's been seen. It's a finite father without following the other two back up to their source. You're not only restoring the true Trinity and everything, I mean, you're liberating the Father from being in bondage to a smallness of our conception.
When I read about the Lord in the Old Testament, that has more of the whole Father and Mother kind of combined, you know?
Yeah, I mean, depending on how the translation is done, I mean, a lot of times, so if the original is Adonai, that will be translated as Lord with just a capital L.
Yeah.
If the original is Yahweh, if it's a tetragrammaton, you know, YHWH, then some translations will do that Lord with all caps.
Oh, okay.
That's Yahweh. These various things. If it's just, say Elohim, it'll be God. But Lord, you know, is part of the picture. It has its negative limitations too, obviously. It tends to get a little bit too close immediately to the notion of he's just the Almighty. all right, let's see. Now I forgot where we were. Where were we? We read the first three. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay, so Eternal Son, God the Son. He's chosen to bring those in this initial handful of things that he's pointing out. And you'll notice, let me just say as we go forward, you see how it starts this very next paragraph. A lot of times he just says the Son rather than the Eternal Son, you know, which technically is just the deity, not the personalized deity, from either a unity or an individuality viewpoint. When you just say the Son, we're just talking about that facet of deity. And so many times he's doing that, you know, in the same way he'll just say the Father. You know, and you can start to reflect on that. It's like, oh, you know, is he trying to point out that, there's a deeper recognition of what he's saying if you kind of go behind personalized deity, you know, just like the foreword starts with deity and then goes to God, you know, is he encouraging me to see? We've alluded to this many times. When you start to get into total deity, you begin to recognize, you can start to understand the nature of the Eternal Son a lot more kind of out of that time sequence. If you first stop just thinking from the individuality viewpoint and using that designation, Eternal Son, or even God the Son. If you just try to figure out the Son, you begin to see how that facet of deity, in some ways, is expressed prior to the Father, as opposed to subsequent to the Father. I mean, you begin to start to get more of an eternity picture, you know, where you can. It's like, well, I could think about it like that, but I could think about it like that too, you know, and I can see that right in front of me. I'm not just sort of, you know, well, I guess I maybe could see it. You know, it's there. You know, you can start to see a little bit more of the picture being liberated from the time sequence picture way. So, you know, that's one of the things that's in play a lot. It's sort of at the higher level of engaging the book when they just say the Son, you know, they're engaging he's encouraging the advanced student to think about it in more of the deity viewpoint. Okay, but we don't have to go into all those details right now. But it's there. Just notice that it's there a lot, where he just says the Son. Okay?
The Son not only possesses all the Father's infinite and transcendent righteousness, but the Son is also reflective of all the Father's holiness of character. The Son shares the Father's perfection and jointly shares the responsibility of abiding, of aiding all creatures of imperfection in their spiritual efforts to attain spirit perfection.
Divine
perfection. The Eternal Son possesses all the Father's character of divinity and attributes of spirituality. The Son is the fullness of the God's of God's absoluteness in personality and spirit. And these qualities the Son reveals in his personal management of the spiritual government of the universe of universes. God is indeed a universal spirit. God is spirit, and the spirit nature of the Father is focalized and personalized in the deity of the eternal Son. In the Son, all spiritual characteristics are apparently greatly enhanced by differentiation from the universality of the first source and center. And as the Father shares his spirit nature with the Son, so do they together just as fully and unreservedly share the divine spirit with the conjoint actor, the infinite spirit.
Okay. You just notice a couple things going on. I mean, a number of this stuff is kind of straightforward. But he's weaving in little things. If we wanted to give a more succinct name to the deity of the eternal Son, that would be
the Son.
See? There it is right there. See? Just like he's been saying so many times. If you're not, just the deity of the eternal Son, not the personalization, of that deity, but just the deity. What kind of deity is that? What kind of an expression of deity is that?
So it's kind of like pre-functionality.
Remember the easiest way the analogy is, you're a self, and then that self is personalized. When you're talking about a creator being, there's deity, there's the self, and then that self is personalized. In the sense that when you're a finaliter, you'll have a divine self. They have a deity self, and then that deity's personalized. Okay, so it's one thing to talk about the personality of the eternal Son. It's another thing to just focus on the self character of the eternal Son. What's the self like? What's that facet of deity like? Even though he's not trying to really flesh that out, this stuff is all kind of played there for you to notice eventually.
We could say he's divinely fraternal deity?
Yes, we could, because that's, all right. Yeah, that facet of deity is called the Son, the initial label up there in the foreword, in the functional levels of total deity, that they label that type of deity divinely revealed deity. Divinely fraternal deity. And then the spirit is divinely revealed deity. Thinking ahead and said the next thing. So divinely fraternal deity and divinely revealed deity are the initial labels they give for what kind of deity the Son and the Spirit is. So they're saying, if you want to boil it down to one label, that Son-type deity is in a very fraternal relationship with the Father. Whereas the Spirit, when all is said and done, there's a relationship there, but we all know that the Spirit is about, the real expression, the spear point. The Father and the Son, they come together and express through and from the Spirit, and that's what they're getting at there in the end of that. And so do they together, just as fully and unreservedly, share the divine Spirit with the conjoint actor. And that's the universal Father and the eternal Son. The relationship between those two is that creator, personal aspect of the third source and center, the conjoint actor. So that's why they say that first. But just because they're talking about the Spirit, they want, for the new reader, they say, we're talking about the infinite Spirit? Yeah. But, of course, technically what it is that personal face is the conjoint actor. What's behind the non-personal substrate of that personal face is the infinite Spirit. Okay, the eternal Son, if you're focusing on this spirit aspect. He wanted to give a proper designation instead of the infinite spirit. The second source and center would be the absolute spirit, capital A, capital S. So one of them is the absolute spirit, and the other one's an infinite spirit. And the difference is that in the absolute spirit case, that is the personal face that's forward. There's an absolute spirit face that's forward. In the case of the conjoined actor, the spirit part is really behind the scenes. Oh, yeah, well, of course. I mean, I can't really engage the infinite level. I mean, the infinite spirit would be behind the whole picture. If I follow my relative fact back, I get to an absolute point. You know, I'm beyond there be mystery. You know, I can't directly connect to the infinite level. You know, so I'm going to see the conjoined actor and the absolute spirit. Okay? But then I know that behind that third source and center, there's a whole bunch of the infinite mind and the infinite spirit and these things that are, you know, transcendent of absoluteness even and very mysterious. Okay. But anyway, so they always are very precise. Like I said, I mean, if technically it's conjoined actor, they'll say that, you know, or they'll say it first like this, and they'll maybe parenthetically give you, conjoined actor, what's that? Oh, the infinite spirit. You know, and initially you can just blur them together and it's okay, you know. But you know, technically it's the conjoined actor that's the personal face, see, so. Right. Okay.
They insert the word focalized here.
Oh yeah. Let's see. Where was it? I was going to bring that out. I forgot. Yeah. Very, very good. Thank you for reminding me of that. So God is indeed a universal spirit. God is spirit, and this spirit nature of the Father is focalized and personalized in the deity of the eternal Son. Focalized is a mother word. All right. Yeah, we know that. Right, so they're reminding you that you've got this existential core of just this personalized deity, but there's an additional thing that's added to that, a focalization, you know, a word that's used to express that phenomenon that's associated with the mother type deity, the coordinate actor. Mm-hmm. That's the focalized part.
Where's that focalized word?
Oh, it's so that third paragraph from the end, in that first sentence, it says the Father is focalized and personalized. It starts with God is indeed a universal spirit. See that paragraph? Oh, 1, 2, 3, yeah, 4, 5, 6, yep. Okay. Yeah. See again, yeah. You guys notice that. You know, why, you know, it's because we put all the pieces together up in the Supreme Papers and we figured out, wait a minute, that focalized word is a technical word that they're using for that coordinate action. You know, another way of describing what coordinate action is focalization. It's a mother action. So they're, you know, again, we've pointed out, you know, when you start thinking about focalization here, this mother column, you know, what's behind that? The Father, the infinite upholder. See? So, you know, that's the spirit of what they're saying there. You know, this spirit and nature of the Father, remember when back in the Father papers, we talked about the spirit nature. We noticed that they were referring to the infinite upholder. All this subtle stuff is in play, tied to the mother too. Okay.
When you use focalization, could it also refer to the self of the Son?
Right. The way we noticed that they were doing that up in the Supreme Papers is, the summation was the Almighty, just the deity, the Almighty. Not God the Almighty, but just the Almighty. That's the summation. The focalization is the mother, just the deity, not the personalization. When you bring in summarizer and focalizer, okay, now we're talking about something that's personalized. We're talking about an actor, okay? And then you would talk about, from the individuality viewpoint, you'd talk about the Almighty Supreme and the Universal Mother, okay? You know, or God the Almighty, God the Mother. So it's definitely has that kind of specificity, you know, is used in this differential between just the deity and the personalized deity. You know, is it an actor? Is there an ER? You know, or not, or is it just the summation or the focalization? Okay. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Gene, because that's a key little kind of between the lines thing there.
In the love of truth and in the creation of beauty, the Father and the Son are equal, except that the Son appears to devote himself more to the realization of the exclusively spiritual beauty of universal values.
Easy tractor.
In divine goodness, I discern no difference between the Father and the Son. The Father loves his universe children as a father, and the Eternal Son looks upon all creatures, both as father and as brother.
Okay, see, so then again, there's just a little bit more. I think that last paragraph is pretty obvious. You see how they're adding the brother part with the Son. But just, you know, notice that, except that the Son appears to devote himself more. Again, this is the face. The spiritual face. Okay, so it can't do anything but appear that way. Right. Okay? Right. Calling your attention. But we all know that when we start to get up in those higher, you know, more advanced papers and we start to think about all, you know, the triodities and all that, and the triunities and all that stuff, and there's always this sort of subtle stuff that's behind what meets the eye, what is apparent. You know, and that's why they italicize that. You know, so that you don't just totally think of the Son as what is apparent. You know, remind yourself that there's some deep, mysterious thing behind that too, that can have connections that really defy expression and any finite mode of expression and stuff. Okay,
even though he's a spiritual administrator, he's not. He has to have, you're saying he has some relationship to energy, to matter.
Yeah.
Even though it's not apparent.
Right, even though it's nothing that's going to be on this side of his absoluteness, you know, in a sense. I mean, he is an infinite personality after all, even though that's, it's nothing that's sort of, yeah, right. I mean, there's always going to be some deep, mysterious thing behind the scenes that in some, you know, probably the only way that you can begin to understand is that because the Son is tied to the Father and the Father is tied to everything, the Son can also be tied to everything. I mean, that's a way of beginning to understand how that could be. But you know, in terms of just the initial understanding, you know, start with what's apparent, you know, and it's the spirit, you know, the purely spiritual fact that's apparent, you know. If you don't do that, you know, you won't appreciate the deep mystery of the Eternal Son's worlds and the beings that are on those worlds, that they're these, somehow they're purely spiritual, they're purely unity-like, they have no individuality-likeness, and so how can they even be persons? I mean, because they're not, I mean, how are they focalized or focalizable? I mean, it's all just very confusing, okay? You know, and so it's important to not, I mean, not only is it apparent, but it's what is engaging the sub-absolute, that apparent fact. The stuff that's behind that is not directly engaging the sub-absolute. So don't bring that in, because then it'll muddle up your understanding of what's going on in the sub-absolute. You know, he is the absolute spirit, not the infinite spirit. Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people initially will be attracted to the sun in their consciousness, and then through the sun maybe gain a greater appreciation of the Father.
And those of us who are students in the Revelation know that this is that's literal. You know, the eternal sun is the anchor point of spirit gravity. That attraction.
Yeah.
He is the attractor, not the Father. He's the attractor.
Okay.
Okay, literally.
I had forgotten.
Yeah. He is anchor point of spirit gravity. It's to him that your adjuster is drawn by spirit gravity. See, and that the differential that brings in, instead of thinking of it, that direct substance attraction of spirit is to the eternal Son, not to the Father. Even though, you always think of the adjuster as, what gets you drawn to the Father. Yeah, drawn to the Father through the Son.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the adjuster is not a person.
Right.
But he's drawn to the personality of the Son.
Right, but just, no, drawn to the spirit fact of the Son. The absolute spirit, it's the attractor of spirit gravity. The absolute spirit fact of the Son is what's drawing all spirit.
When you see Krishna in these paintings and the whole lore, he falls much more under this attractor.
Right, and that's why when you go and read about Hinduism in the papers, they bring that up.
When they say, in the love of truth and the creation of the beauty of the Father and the Son, are they bringing up an inevitable there attached to something? Is that what they're saying, or am I misinterpreting?
Don't take it that far yet. Remember, this is just about the nature of the eternal Son. This is not about things that result from that, which is getting to inevitabilities and things. You're just trying to understand the nature of the Son, where he fits into the picture. And notice they're doing, and then let's wrap it up here. They're doing two things. One, they're trying to give you some sense of the distinction between the Father and the Son, but then they don't allow you to make that sort of an absolute separation. They immediately say, but there is also much, that they're connected to. And how could it be otherwise? If literally when I go to paradise and the deity presence is the center, that there is no window to the Father. You got to go through the Son, no matter how you come at it. The Father is completely enshrouded by the Son. So there has to be a very direct linkage, or even you might even say overlap. In the sense of that overlapping, of the Son about the Father.
That's
the
best approach.
And again, another way is just the unity viewpoint. There's just God. Yeah, there's facets, but it's just God. Okay, so it has to be an overlap,
And being fully divested, what does that make the Son? When you take those original attributes that weren't differentiated initially and divest.
Oh yeah.
Make the Son.
Did you notice here? Just one more little thing. Did you notice how they pointed that out? That at the same time, the Father freed himself. That frees the Son too. They pointed that out. It works both ways. The Son can only be the purity that he is because the Father's not muddying up those waters, and vice versa. Okay. So, they did try to bring that out. So that's the whole point. We want to. Another reason why you separated everything, so that there can be this really pure expression of unity and a really pure expression of it all in harmony. But there's a very pure expression of individuality and a very pure expression of unity. All right, let's take a moment to reflect on that.